entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Oh, it sure is. Hello there, and a good Sunday morning to you on this fifth day of August. It is the Best of Downtown, our look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. Rich Kimble here, along with Carrie Haskell. Best of Downtown brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. On the program, a wide range of topics and conversation this morning, as we'll hear from author Mark Diano, talking about his terrific new book, Gods of Wood and Stone. Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, a little sports media, a little bit of Boston sports. Actress Melanie Lynskey talks about her role in the new series Castle Rock, as well as looking back at some of her other memorable roles in both television and in film. But we get things rolling this morning with a little relationship advice, if you or a friend might need it here. This came about a week and a half ago when our friend Dennis Price was sitting in with us. We talked with a relationship expert, Dr. Laura Ciel, all about first dates. We want to talk a little bit about first dates. Now, none of us here will have any more, at least we're hoping not. I mean, if things continue to go well, but certainly somebody listening might benefit from this. How early in a first date, how soon is too soon to start looking for signs whether this is going to be successful or not?
You know what I say is it's never too soon. And actually, I say I have people set up before they even go on the date so that they can recognize some of those little signs that might tip us off. I mean, my view is why, especially if you're, you know, a little bit older than in your teenage years, why would you want to waste any time if it's just not going to be something that's wonderful and fulfilling for you? So it's never too soon.
Are the signs different for individuals, or are there some standards that might apply for everybody?
You know, the tricky thing about setting up ahead of time is we're all different, and we all want something different in our relationship. However, we all, at the base of it, we want to be loved, and we want to love. So it's really, how does that get played out for you? And the more that you know about that, the more you're going to be able to recognize some of those signs and symbols. So the ones that would be consistent across the board, it might look differently, but you're going to feel it. You're going to feel that something just doesn't feel good. You don't want to stay there. That's a really big red flag.
And you know, hello, it's good to speak with you. I'm Dennis. I'm joining today, and I'm so excited.
Hi, Dennis. To
hear about this, because I was always getting nervous. I was always worried in terms of my, you know, how was my, because you remember, you don't ever get a second chance to make a first impression, right? And so that's when I was always trying to make sure that I was right in there. But then sometimes, you know, you think, well, you got to be yourself. How do you deal with that sort of thing? Those nerves.
You know, it's great because a lot of times on that first date, you want to make a good impression, right? We have a tendency to focus outside ourselves. We want to look good. We want to be perceived as whatever, smart, funny, romantic, whatever it is, right? And sometimes we can get so caught up in that we forget we're more worried about how the other person's going to perceive us than we are about really being true to who we are.
Yeah.
And what I say to people is, if you don't show up who you are, well, you're creating something that's not sustainable in the long run. So who wants that?
Yeah, well, that's good. Good to know. I should have heard this 20 years ago.
How important?
I think a lot of us could benefit from that.
Yeah.
How important is it on those first date situations, Laura, to ask questions, to try and learn about the person you're with?
Well, it's really important because it's showing that you have a desire to know who you're with, as opposed to just kind of how someone shows up on the outside. The other thing is everyone actually really enjoys being asked about, you know, so it's showing attempting to connect and have a real meaningful interaction, even if it's not long-term relationship. So it's really important, but just as important is sharing a little bit of who you are and what matters to you. And I'm not talking about sharing details about past relationships. No, that's
not. Right. Be careful there.
TMI. Sharing the things that really turn you on and sharing the things that you that you love about life and sharing the things that you want to share in life. And, you know, you don't want to go too far that direction either on a first date. You don't want to be locking someone into a long-term relationship.
That's
you want
right.
to share a little bit of who you are and what turns you on, as well as asking those questions of the other person.
Yeah, and it's not about just clicking off all the items on your resume.
Absolutely not. You know, I tell people it's really good to have some things that are definite no-nos so that you can just check those off and go, okay, thank you, but no, thank you, this isn't going to work. But I try to help people expand their idea of what it is they want beyond some, you know, 10 quality checklist, because you don't know. You don't know who's going to show up and what, how they're going to show up, and there might be something even better than you're expecting that's there and available.
We're talking with Dr. Laura Ciel here on Downtown. In this day and age when technology is often a factor in leading to first dates, does that maybe improve the success rate of first dates since you've been able to do a little advanced scouting perhaps through the internet?
It could improve it, or it could do a lot of damage. You think about if when you were you were much younger, whether or not you'd want everything on, you know, spread out there on social media. You know, honestly, I think that teenagers and young adults have a really difficult time right now in some aspects because they can't show up and really have that first date, first impression, because the impression has already been made. So, you know, and sometimes we're not always smart about what we put on social media, and someone can come to conclusions that aren't necessarily consistent with who you are. So I actually think there's a little bit of a disadvantage to that for the younger people, because it's so they're on social media so much. But you know what? For everyone, but especially those who are maybe going into second, you know, maybe a divorce or breakup after many, many years together, going out there back into the dating world, it can be a little scary. So there is something that's positive about being able to learn a little bit about the person before you go and spend some time. So there are some positive aspects, but sometimes I think it can hurt our first impression.
So you're on that first date and you realize that at least for you, there is no interest in a second date. How do you exit gracefully?
Yeah, good question.
People don't like this answer, but I have spoken to so many people on the receiving end of it and nothing but positive. What you want to do is you want to make sure that you're speaking in a really clear and compassionate way. So you're clear that this is not, you know, you don't want to invest any more time and energy in this. And just saying something really simple like, I have so appreciated getting to know you, because it's true, you learned information. I mean, grateful you got the information that you needed to make the decision. You know, I've so appreciated your time. I've so appreciated, you know, some version of that. And then I don't see this going any further. And I just want to thank you so much. I'm really grateful that I got to know you, and I wish you the best.
Should you continue that first date if you've made, let's say you've determined, oh, we're going to do dinner and a movie, but before the main course gets there, you realize this is going nowhere. Do you end it early, or do you play out the entire night before you deliver that news?
Well, that's a good question.
I am a firm believer in if you have clarity, sharing that information and having a graceful thank you and good night. I really think that is important. Now, you can have a conversation if someone maybe has invested in, you know, maybe there are tickets to something, you know, maybe there's something that's happening that was an investment and set up that can't be undone. A conversation can be had. Look, I understand that you got tickets. I would still really love to go with you if that's true. And if it's not, you know, I hope that you can find someone else. But, you know, an acknowledgement that there was some effort put out by that person to set up something really beautiful while also being true to what you believe and what you need. And what I find when I talk to people on the receiving end of this, and I'm talking about a kind, compassionate, clear message, they say, I was so grateful to him or to her because I didn't waste any more time trying.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's an appreciation for there's actually an honoring of the other person's time and energy.
Absolutely.
Honestly.
And that's a great perspective, because I always am drawn to the truth, being truthful. Right. The truth is the easiest story to remember. And sometimes, you know, I feel like you're right. sometimes it's not like a romantic comedy. You just need to say, listen, I appreciate this, but like you said, you have to be truthful and honest. Then that makes me ask this question, you know, how truthful, you know, do you want to be? And of course, you know, truth without compassion is cruelty, right? Isn't that what they say? And so, you know, you want to toe that fine line and see that. How would you do that?
Yeah, you know, and when you said that truth, I always have a little bit of my body kind of goes with the truth thing, because sometimes people take that as an invitation to share everything that they're thinking, and that's not necessarily the best response.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
If you're with someone, let's just say you're with someone, and maybe their body hygiene is just not, you just know that this is not going to work for you, and you know. It's a first date. You don't know this person very well. I don't think you want to get into details about that. You can just say, I don't feel it's going to work out for me, you know, and you put it back on you. And so that's not being dishonest. It's being very honest, but it's being very compassionate. You know, if it's a first date, I mean, so we're talking a big difference between first date and, you know, a relationship of several months where you can have a different kind of conversation. First date, you know, you only have that time. And so just being a kind person and saying, I don't think this is going to work out for me. And I really appreciate, you know, this, that, I really appreciate dinner. I really appreciate whatever, but I wish you the best, and thank you so much for this time that we did have.
Sincerity, it sounds like.
Sincerity.
You're not trying to be a put on. You're not, as my mother would say, mm-hmm. you know, put on airs. You just want to be sincere and real. There's something refreshing.
Yeah, and that's and that will be, and again, that's when I talk to people on the receiving end, that person will be grateful, because who really truly wants to spend time, invest time and energy and money sometimes in dating someone who already has that feeling of, ooh, I don't know, because you don't really have a chance at that point. And sometimes we're so focused on pleasing the other person or showing up a certain way for the other person that can get us into a really weird dynamic where then we don't want to hurt them, and then we want to, ooh, and then I think of my body kind of clenches up again. It's like we're trying to squeeze into something to try to make something that isn't working pretend like it is working, but without hurting the other person's feelings. It's just a big contortion, right? It doesn't end up falling very gracefully on the other person's ears at that point.
And if you're on the receiving end of that message, I'm guessing, be grateful that they've been that honest and open, but maybe don't ask follow-up questions.
Yes,
right. Oh, I
would not. Yeah, no, that's it. That is it.
Not necessarily. Just recognize, I mean, what I would say if you're on the receiving end of it, recognize and be honest with yourself that you want someone who can't wait to be with you.
Right.
And so thank you to this person who could kind of care less, because you're not going to waste any more time. You're going to go on to another first date, and maybe that person just can't wait to see you again. And isn't that what we all want?
So
you know, someone who really loves being with us.
So it sounds like the same rules that keep long-term relationships successful apply mm-hmm. to first dates as well. Open communication and honesty.
Absolutely. And I like to say, when you are saying something from a place of you feel good and solid in yourself, and you're able to open up your heart. So I would say you're strong, you're solid, you're in integrity, you are coming from a place of love, and you're being honest about your feelings, about how you feel. That's absolutely. And I agree. First date, it could be 3 months down the road, and it could be 20 years, you know, 20 years long relationship. It's really important for both people. You know, it's not the other person's responsibility to guess or to know what's going on. It's your responsibility to be clear about what's going on with you and what you need going forward.
That's author and relationship expert Dr. Laura Ciel here on The Best of Downtown. When we return, it's Chad Finn of the Boston Globe, sports media and more next on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
We're back. Best of Downtown on your Sunday morning. Time to talk a little Boston sports media and all the things we chat about when Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and Boston.com pays a visit to us. Let's talk about a couple of pieces that you wrote over the weekend I thought were just terrific. Let's start with a wonderful piece you did. And by the way, right there, front page of my sports section yesterday in the Sunday Boston Globe, a wonderful piece on the NBA Summer League in 03 that introduced LeBron to the world.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it looks really cool online because our designers are involved with it, but they gave me 2 pages inside, which, given the limited real estate and print these days, is a lot of space. It was an oral history of the 03 Summer League, which a lot of people have kind of forgotten was in Boston, or if you're younger, you probably didn't know in the first place. But for 5 years, the NBA Summer League was kind of a quaint thing in the old gym at UMass Boston across the street from the Globe. And the last year it was here, LeBron played in it. It wasn't his first step into pro ball because he played a couple games in the Orlando League before that. But it was where all the hype actually met what he actually was as a player. Everybody was there to kind of scope out and see if the hype was real. And if you read my piece, you realize all these veteran NBA guys realized it pretty quickly. But it was a really fun thing to put together. I actually came up with the idea a couple of years ago and started chipping away on it here and there. But we really got going on it over the last couple of months. And we were hoping it lined up with free agency or lined up with Summer League. And we ended up running a little bit later than that. But it was still something that my bosses fortunately felt was worthwhile.
Well, it was terrific. It was a wonderful read. And it's amazing how much the league, and the Summer League in particular, has changed just in those 15 years or so since then.
Yeah, it was in Boston for those 5 years, and it was in that tiny little gym, and it cost $8 most years to get in, and it was 16 the summer of LeBron. You can't get anything for $16 these days, so it was a pretty good deal. And it was a month after Danny Ainge had taken over the Celtics. They had their hotshot young players there, Marcus Banks and Kendrick Perkins. There's some funny anecdotes about him in there, but it was sort of a casual thing more than anything else. The players mingled among the fans and in a side locker room, wait, get autographs. You might be standing behind the first round pick for the Atlanta Hawks in the concession line to get popcorn. And now it's a really elaborate thing. It's really an extension in a way of the season or a real part of the NBA landscape where all 30 teams are involved now out in Las Vegas. And it's kind of where everybody has to be at that point in the summer. It's a real meeting place. It wasn't like that at all 15 years ago. It was a real more laid back sort of casual vibe. And it's kind of cool to think of LeBron being part of that because he's a big reason why everything in the league has become as big as it has.
It reminded me very much of when I was in my early 20s. I was a college student, but I was working radio part-time and went down several years in a row to spring training with a press pass, although I had no real official business. But I managed to wangle a press pass, and those were in the days when, well, I remember one day sitting at a game in Vero Beach, I think it was, and Bill Lee just came up and sat in the stands for the game, and you could wander among the players. And you know, now you go, and it's a big time production. Spring training isn't a whole lot different than going to see a regular season game.
Yeah, they figured out how to monetize everything, and you know, justifiably. I mean, it's people go, people pay to go to this stuff, the NBA Summer League, just spring training to. I mean, we're seeing it right now, Patriots training camp. I started covering that when I worked in Concord, New Hampshire, right after I graduated from UMaine, and I'd go down for a couple days in the summer, and the players just, they stayed in the dorms at Bryant College then, and there was no media where you put in a request to say, I need this guy or that guy. You just kind of hung around until you saw them, and you'd go sit down and have lunch with them. And this was into the late 90s. I mean, I can remember Lawyer Malloy 1 year flipped out on Pete Carroll, and he did it in that circumstance where he was just asked about a question. They cut Willie Clay, who's the other starting safety, not a great player, but a well-regarded guy in the locker room. And they caught him, and the veterans were ticked off. And rather than sort of sequestering Malloy, making sure none of the media talked to him, he just came out of lunchroom one day, was asked about it by one of the beat guys, and went off. And there's no PR people around to kind of say, all right, let's take a step back, like we saw. You know, like we saw the other day when Brady was asked that question. It's completely changed, and it's good and bad. I mean, if obviously the way things are done these days for the Patriots work, the way spring training has become an event for a lot of fans is a great thing. The NBA Summer League is a great thing, but you can kind of long for those too when things are a little bit more easier, more casual.
Well, if you haven't read it yet, go online and check out Chad's piece on the Summer League of 03. Really is terrific. You also had a chance to talk with Bob Costas, who was honored out in Cooperstown at the Hall of Fame this weekend. And despite everything that he's done in his career, as he pointed out to you, it in many ways begins and ends with baseball for him.
Have you ever had him on?
Yes, we have. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah, he's much more accessible nowadays, especially no longer having the Olympic commitments where, you know, he's a primetime host, I think, for 11 Olympics starting in 08. He's very available to talk about his love for baseball. I think he really enjoys doing the MLB Network games that he's been doing for the last couple of years. He's kind of easing into the latter stages of his career the way that he wants to. And I'm of a certain generation. You know, I grew up in the 80s, and the world was talking about how the world was different a minute ago. The world was really different then, and how you followed baseball. You had two games of the week on NBC on Saturdays, and one was usually West Coast, one was East Coast, and you got one or the other. And Costas and Tony Kubek, who were fantastic together, was one of the broadcast teams. The other one was Vince Scully and Joe Garagiola, who was obviously a fantastic team as well. And so that's the only way you saw, you know, the Dodgers, or you saw the great pitchers in the National League, because you didn't have it on your phone readily available. You didn't have every game on TV every night if you paid for the MLB package. It's something I would have dreamed of at that age, but it was never something that you ever thought would be possible. And so it was a bit more mystery in baseball and about what was going on in the other league. And Costas was one of the great voices at that time of the person who was broadcasting the game where you didn't know a lot about the players who were playing in it. And he's somebody I've always really liked. He's an approachable guy for the fame that he has. He really, really has loved his job and is appreciative for all the success that he's had. It's kind of like he's had his dream life. So I always enjoy talking to him. And of course, he's as articulate as it gets in saying what he wants to say. So really happy for him for getting that award this weekend.
Yeah, very well deserved. And you're right. He's just a good guy. He's been really helpful to young broadcasters throughout his career, and has given back because he understands. And I've heard him tell the story of how, you know, like so many people, he was schlepping around to high school games, broadcasting those as a kid, and got a job doing hockey, though he'd never done hockey before, by sitting down and recording play-by-play for a hockey game while watching it on TV. And he has never forgotten that. That's one of the things I like about him.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the way I first met him was probably five or six years ago, where I had written something saying this broadcaster sounds like he's doing a Bob Costas imitation. And I didn't mean it as an insult to Bob Costas. I meant that the guy didn't have a style of his own. And somehow I got back to Costas. He's like, well, he got in touch with me through NBC at the time. It was like, is that supposed to be an insult? I'm not quite sure how to take that. And we ended up having lunch with him next time he was in Boston and talking about those things. And he's just somebody who's really down to earth and grounded success that he's had, and he remembers the names of the people who helped him along the way, and he's paying that forward for sure.
Chad Finn with us here on Downtown. Well, Tony Maserati is at it again. I understand the coin of the realm there in Boston radio is edgy comments, but when you try to insult someone, in this case Tom Brady, by calling him Tommy Girl, has he not been paying attention to what's going on in the world?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I had it on TV watching a simulcast because I'm working from Scenic Wells, Maine today, where I live. And he said it once, and I was like, okay, you know, that's a dumb thing to say. The producers miss, they knock it off. And he said it again, and then he said it, I think, one more time, where it was either he's crying like a little girl or he called him Tommy Girl, you know, play on the Chris Farley movie Tommy Boy. Which, you know, is a good movie, but not exactly the most timely reference in the world either. And so he kept doing that. So I just tweeted out, you know, how stupid it was of him to keep saying this. And I coached basketball at youth level for 6 or 7, probably longer than that, both girls and boys. And my experience is the girls are much more fun to coach when they're younger because they focus more, they pay more attention. Yes, they cry when you lose a big game or they fall and get hurt, but so do the boys. And that's just the kind of lame thing that you say when you're in third grade and you're scared of girls. Somebody's a girl. But that was something you said in the 70s, not something you say now. I think everybody should know better. He means it as an insult, and it's absolutely not an insult. So I'm glad to say something about that.
Well, good. I'm glad you called him out on that. On the good news side of things, my gosh, the Red Sox just taking us to new heights, 41 games over 500 for the first time since the pennant-winning season of 1946. And I know it's all about winning the World Series, but I'm trying to just slow it all down and enjoy every minute with this team. They've been so much fun this year.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. I mean, think back to the people are telling you right now. Mavs probably being one of them that they haven't proven anything until they win the World Series. Well, sure, okay. I heard this in 2013, too, that roster wasn't built to win a World Series right up until about Game 6 of the World Series. So don't dwell on what might happen or what you feel like needs to happen to justify the time investment you put into a team. Think of all the years where they didn't win, and you still got great memories to take away from it, whether that's 75 or Dave Henderson's home run in 86, some of the great things that happened in 03, or just individual awesome yas in 67, things that make you happy to be a Red Sox fan. Those things are happening right now with this team, no matter how well it turns out. You're going to talk about the season Mookie Betts is having. You're going to talk about the 2018 season Chris Sale is having and what a great free agent signing J.D. Martinez is and how Xander Bogaerts is finally become the player people wanted him to be. There's a lot to like about the team. And I think the vast majority of fans are really enjoying it. There's an element that says, you still got to prove it to me. I get that to some degree, but I hope that doesn't get in the way of the enjoyment of appreciating what the team is doing because it's absolutely remarkable.
Really poignant moment over the weekend. Our friend Tim Neverett, one of the radio broadcasters, his dad passed away, and then Mookie Betts had that remarkable walk-off game-winning home run that night that took on added significance for Tim, who said, tweeted out, my dad was looking out for me with this great finish.
Yeah, Tim's a great guy, too. He's grown on me a lot as a Red Sox broadcaster, and he's someone who, he's one of the guys front center on having proper perspective of this team and appreciating what they're achieving, even though, you know, October may bring things you don't like. You never know. But I think Tim's one of those guys who really, really likes what this team is doing. And he's with them every day. He knows it's a good group of guys. Maybe not the most charismatic bunch in front of the cameras, but certainly when they're on the field. And now, front and center for this, at some point, Alex Cora is going to get a lot of credit for what's going on here, too, because he's been everything you could have possibly wanted him to be as a new manager of this team.
I also think, too, you could have it a lot worse. You could be Maine natives Gary Thorne and Mike Bordick trying to make those Orioles games interesting to listen to.
Yeah, my colleague Nick Cafardo wrote his Sunday baseball notes lead this week was on how Dan Duquette should keep his job. And he's made some good trades for Manny Machado, Zach Britton to get prospects back into the organization. Boy, when you're 40-something games out in August, in July, it's not even August yet, and the farm system is still pretty barren, and there's really no future with the major league roster at this point. It's tough to make the argument that a GM that has overseen that gets to keep his position.
It's Chad Finn of the Boston Globe here on the Best of Downtown. When we return, author Mark Deano talks about a terrific new book entitled Gods of Wood and Stone. It's up next on Downtown.
We may not be the biggest, but we're definitely the best. Here at Tim's Plumbing, we know that when a plumbing issue pops up, you need it fixed. And not just fixed fast, but fixed right. That's been our mission from day one. The master licensed technicians here at Tim's Plumbing specialize in installations, repiping, and service repair. We do new construction as well. And we're so focused on customer satisfaction that 100% of Tim's Plumbing customers become repeat customers. Here at Tim's Plumbing, we replace and repair water heaters, install and repair well pumps. We even do kitchen and bath remodeling. Keep our numbers handy. You can call us at 735-4969 or 327-1620. Those numbers again, 735-4969 or 327-1620. You can also learn more about the many services we offer by liking us on Facebook or by clicking your way to timsplumbingmaine.com. That's timsplumbingmaine.com. At Tim's Plumbing, service is our specialty.
Hey, Rex, Fiona, the mail's here.
I was supposed to fetch that. My bad.
Any cardboard boxes today?
More fan letters. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, thank you for boarding our dog and cat while we were away. It's easy to see why you've been voted the Bangor region's best kennel every year since 2002.
That's 1906 in dog years.
She goes on to ask, why do cats play with yarn?
Because we can't knit.
Here's another. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, your dog groomer is the best. Louie never looked or felt better. Why does Louie turn around three times before he lies down?
Because dogs can't count to four.
Here's one. Dear Green Acres Kennel Shop, do dogs like to go to obedience school?
They do when it's at Green Acres Kennel Shop. We were voted one of the top 30 dog trainers in all of New England. Private and group training classes are available. We make you and your dog best friends for life.
How do you think we learned how to talk?
Green Acres Kennel Shop, voted one of the top 10 kennels in New England. 1653 Union Street, Bangor, greenacreskennel.com, and on Facebook. Your dog may not actually talk. Woof.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home. Woof, woof.
We're back on the Best of Downtown. Your Sunday morning, Rich Kimball and Carrie Haskell with
well,
you.
Well, I stood stone-like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade. And I combed my hair, it was just right, and commanded the night brigade.
Our next guest on Downtown, a longtime columnist for the Newark Star-Ledger, teaches at Rutgers, is a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and is the author of a terrific new novel entitled Gods of Wood and Stone. Here's our conversation from Thursday's show with author Mark Deano. This is such a fun book. I loved it. And for you, it's an interesting chance to tap in to a lot of your talents as a guy who started as a sports writer for the New York Post and now working as a columnist. You bring all of those skills together in writing about these two very distinctive characters in this book.
Well, I'm also the father of six children, so I think maybe more than anything that factored in. But when I broke into sports writing, you know, in the 1980s, there were guys that were sort of on the cusp of being the old breed, and you know, and they were marching off the timeline. Guys like Carlton Fisk and Jack Youngblood from the Rams and. You know, these sort of old-time athletes. And Carlton Fisk had a confrontation with Deion Sanders once at Yankee Stadium. And I wrote a column about it. You know, Carlton Fisk had to spend 2 years in the National Guard before he could play professional baseball. And, you know, Deion Sanders was there with the diamond earrings and the chains, and he was a $1 million bonus baby in two leagues. And so this conflict of cultures really interested in me. And so in the book, the ball player is Joe Grudek, Boston Red Sox catcher. And his playing life is sort of modeled after Carlton Fisk. And that's it, because I don't know Carlton Fisk at all. But, you know, he's just like the last of the old-time ball players and kind of disgusted with the way things have gone in his sport.
Yeah, and Joe Grudek about to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. And every time there's a retrospective on his career, one of the images that is always shown is him cleaning out a guy in a brawl. And so he is the quintessential baseball tough guy.
Yeah, he's a baseball tough guy. And that's one of the elements of the book, Rich, is that the other character in the book, who is a blacksmith at the farm museum in Cooperstown, is the 19th century tough guy. You know, the blacksmith was the epitome of masculinity. He was the guy that put his hands in the fire and he could bend metal and lift up the leg of a horse. And in the 19th century rural America, it was the blacksmith who was held up as a man. And that gave way to the athlete in modern times. And so because the setting is in Cooperstown and the Farm Museum is a real place and the Hall of Fame is a real place, I set the book there to show this cultural clash of, you know, rural America versus modern America, popular culture. One guy is on the one spectrum that is, you know, is almost forgotten. He's toiling in the dark in a museum, smithy, and the other guy is always in the light. He's always under the lights, and he's famous. And so the characters are very much the same kind of man, both wishing that things were the way they used to be, but they're also very different in terms of where they are on the spectrum of popularity.
Also very interesting in the way they have dealt with women and relationships in their lives. Joe Grudek has never been married, has taken advantages of his celebrity along the way when it comes to his interactions with women. And Horace Mueller has a wife, but it's not a happy marriage. It's painful reading that chapter where we learn what that relationship is like with his wife.
Someone told me that the opening of Horace Mueller's the chapter where he's waking up next to his wife is the best description of marital discord they ever read. So I think, and I've been divorced twice, so I think that's another area of expertise. But it's funny because I always say to people, you know, if there's one thing I know about women, it's that I don't know anything about women. and so, but I do know about, romantic discord. And I do know about, having been around ball players, know what gets thrown at them and how callous they can be at times about women. This is no secret. And so the ball player in the book, Joe Grudek, has his Me Too moment when he's a very, very, very young man, a minor leaguer. But then he grows to kind of hate himself for that and detest what he sees around him, while he also, picks his spots and he's so emotionally detached from these women that it's just all about, one night stands and paid for sex, because he doesn't trust that anybody will love him for who he is, just what he is. And that, I think, is the strongest theme of the book, is the alienation of celebrity. That, for Joe Grudek, it's not about who he is, it's about who he was. And that's what it's going to be for the rest of his life.
And I thought,
just going to be that guy.
And I thought one of the most poignant parts of the book was that celebrity extended to his father, and that his father identified himself as Joe's dad. And he keeps saying, that's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to look up to your father. He's the guy you put up on a pedestal.
Right. And I think, again, one of the most poignant scenes is when the father's dying and he's asking his son about how he did last night and what are your playoff chances and, how you hit and how you see the ball. And at that point, Joe Grudek realizes in his whole life, since from Little League on, he's never had a conversation with anybody about anything but himself and how he is doing in a sport. And that's a very kind of a heartbreaking revelation to him. that everyone close to him identifies him only as an athlete, and no one has ever really, and he hasn't allowed anyone ever to get any closer to him.
We're talking with Mark Deano about his book, Gods of Wood and Stone. Your experience as a parent certainly came to bear in writing about the relationship between Horace Mueller and his son, who, as fate would have it, turns out to be not only a lover of sports, but a very good athlete himself. That causes some tensions in the family. And boy, nothing more awkward in that family relationship than that birthday celebration when the son and his friends want to go to the Hall of Fame, and instead they spend way too much time at the Farm Museum.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes in the book, and Horace is oblivious to his son's wishes, but he is also so damn determined to create a well-rounded kid that, you know, he's blinded by that. Now, I have six children. I have three boys and three girls. And they all played sports. And so I spent, I have custody of my younger four children. I'm a single father with four kids, you know, and I, through their junior high school and middle school and high school years and their sports years. And so, you know, I was the guy who was caddying them around to all these places. And I remember one Mother's Day, my youngest daughter had a soccer game, a travel soccer game on Mother's Day. And I said to the coach, you know, if her mom was still around, we wouldn't be here. You know, this is like just, you know, give it a break, man. You know, Mother's Day, we got to travel to three counties to play an 11-year-old girl soccer game. Like, and, you know, you guys know, very well, you know, these youth sports have become 24/7 traveling teams and money makers and, and this kind of stuff. And everything else is falling by the wayside. You know, Boy Scouts, church, knowledge of nature, knowledge of constellations, knowledge of a greater world around you is falling by the wayside because of youth sports. And our kids really aren't learning anything beyond that. And they're breaking down. You know, that's the other thing. You know, their bodies are being punished. And Horace, the blacksmith, sees this. He's like, this is crazy. Like, you know, we're this kid, all he does is play baseball. He doesn't know anything else at this point. And he wants to pull him back and teach him about what he sees is the authentic culture of America, not the pop culture driven by sports and entertainment celebrity.
I also think it seems to me that a recurring theme in the book is the idea of masculinity, what it means to be a man, what it meant for Horace and for Joe when they were growing up, and what it means for the next generation.
Yeah, I think that's a great topic. And you know, one of my goals as a writer is to sort of bring literary fiction back to men. You know, when my agent took on the book, he said, you know, don't be surprised if we don't sell the book because nobody wants to read about middle-aged, disillusioned white guys. And I said, well, that's because nobody puts out anything for them. You know, maybe if there were books that, you know, captured their lives, you know, like the old days with, you know, Updike and Cheever and these guys, you know, maybe you'd find that they do sell. So, you know, I think that is a big subject. You know, what's happened to masculinity? What's happened to manhood? How men as, you know, in our protective nature are lampooned for that now. I think that many fathers feel in their households that, you know, the mom and the children sort of run in the same orbit and dad's on the outside looking in. And, you know, certainly I think, you know, we're men of around the same generation, I imagine. And, you know, when your father and my father were in the house, they were, they were respected. You know, you watch television and every commercial, you know, the dad or the father's the imbecile, you know, there's this whole culture of debasing manhood and debasing fatherhood. And I don't think I'm paranoid when I say that. I think that's a pretty valid observation.
And now I understand why I like the book so much. It's because I realize, thank you, Mark, what a disillusioned middle-aged white guy I am.
Well, hey, I'm in the newspaper business, so, you know.
Well, I do radio and then teach school, so I can't win either way.
Right, right.
And I got a four-year-old running around at home and trying to figure out how to help him navigate through the rocky shoals of being a young man in this day and age. I don't want to give away too much because I don't want any spoilers here, but I have to say the opening of the book, that's about as solid and memorable and unforgettable an opening. Can you describe briefly what sets up learning the background of these two characters when they meet each other at Cooperstown?
Well, I think the most interesting part of this, that opening, and we'll tell people. Maybe it'll make them interested in reading the book. The blacksmith jumps up on the stage and with a long-handled hammer smashes the induction plaque of Joe Grudek. And Joe Grudek has absolutely no idea who this guy is or why he's attacking him. He's got no idea. And one of the interesting parts is that description of Joe Grudek's catcher's eyes. He takes everything in so quickly and evaluates it, you know, from all those years behind the plate. And so he recognizes right away that the guy doesn't have a gun, that he's bootlegging a hammer or something else. And so he doesn't run from the stage. He's going to, in his Joe Grudek way, he's going to take this guy on. And there, a fight ensues, and Grudek is injured in the fight. And it's another example of his deterioration of his body and his aches and pains. And the blacksmith, man is about the same age and same size. He's been working hard, all these years. He's ready for it.
And the irony there is that it keeps Joe from giving this speech that he's thought about so long and so hard that probably would have found a rapt audience in Horace.
Right. And exactly. That's exactly the point of the book, is that these two guys are so similar, but because they are on the opposite ends of the popular culture spectrum, Horace makes Grudek out to be this mortal enemy, and it's over a misunderstanding involving Horace's son. And so the way I wrote the book was, I thought that the best structure was to start with that incident at the induction ceremony and then work back towards how these two guys ended up on a collision course. And I think that was the right choice. Rich, when you structure a book, you just don't know sometimes if you're going in the right direction. But I think it held people's attention, and they wanted to know, what the hell's this guy? What the hell happened?
Absolutely. I think it's a terrific read. Two really powerful characters in Horace and Joe. And look, if you're a baseball fan, you're going to love it. But even if you don't care about baseball, you're going to find this a really compelling read. The book is Gods of Wood and Stone. Mark Deanna, wonderful book, and so great to talk with you. Thanks for making time for us this afternoon.
Rich, thanks very much. And if you're a blacksmith fan, you'll like the book too.
Yeah, and they are, they're coming back. We're making America great again, right?
You bet.
Thank you, Mark.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Bye bye. That's Mark Deanna talking about his great new book, Gods of Wood and Stone, here on The Best of Downtown. When we come back, one of those actresses that you constantly see in movies and television shows. And for my money, just never turns in a bad performance. One of the best in the business stars in the new series based on Stephen King's writings entitled Castle Rock. Melanie Lynskey up next on Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome. With more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever. Capable, built to serve, rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel driver options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport, hartleyscountry.com.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomeperformance.com. Back on the Best of Downtown, our next guest, probably best known for several appearances, 63 appearances in all on the CBS series Two and a Half Men. She's also turned in a long list of memorable performances, starting at the age of 16 when she appeared in Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. And since then, films like Coyote Ugly, Up in the Air, Win Win, television shows like Togetherness on HBO, and she's one of the stars of the new series Castle Rock on Hulu. We had a chance to catch up with actress Melanie Lynskey just a couple of days ago. I don't know if you know this, but our radio station is owned by Stephen King. And last week, we hosted a premiere of the first two episodes of Castle Rock, and Stephen was there to introduce the evening.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. That would have been so much fun.
Well, let's talk about your character. Molly Strand in Castle Rock is so interesting, such a complex character. It has to be fun for you as an actor, but also a great challenge.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing I was so excited about, was just how challenging I thought it was going to be. I initially just read the pilot, and she's not in the pilot too much, so I had the next couple of episodes kind of explained to me. And then when I read them, it was beyond even what I had hoped for. It was so crazy and interesting. I felt very lucky.
And I understand that you and everybody involved were pretty relieved and quite happy when you got the news that Stephen not only approved of the script, but was excited about it and liked what he had seen.
Yeah, I was very relieved about that. I mean, it's interesting because the pressure was kind of off in terms of, you know, the fact that we weren't making a straight adaptation, which is always a little bit scary. But then you do hope, you know, it's so inspired by his work, and I knew how much it would mean to Sam and Dusty, the creators of our show, to have Stephen's blessing. So I felt very, very relieved when he was okay with what he had seen. He liked it.
But you've got some experience, too, with King's characters because you played Rachel in Rose Red.
Yeah, I mean, that was, oh my gosh, so many years ago now. But what a fun experience. And that was something that he wrote directly for the screen, so I got to really perform his work. That's so funny that you just brought up Rose Red, because Emily Deschanel, who's one of my dear friends who I met on Rose Red, just texted me just this minute. Funny timing.
Absolutely. There, the cast of Castle Rock is so amazing. Andre Holland is just delightful. Sissy Spacek, of course, Scott Glenn, and Bill Skarsgård, who was so good in It. Just a talented group to be with.
Oh, my gosh. The core cast is just so brilliant and so talented. So, you really knew, you know, whenever I was going to work, I just knew no matter who my scene was with, it was going to be really fun and really challenging. And then not only that, but the actors that they brought in for supporting roles, like Alison Tolman, who plays my sister, and Noel Fisher, and the younger kids, you know, Khalil Harris is so good, and it really was an amazing, amazing group of people.
I understand, though, you shot for about 6 or 7 months in Massachusetts, and I hear it got a little cold toward the end of the shoot.
Yeah. I'm from New Zealand, so I can handle a lot of rain because it never stops raining in New Zealand. But very freezing cold, I've never dealt with before. And we had an hour drive to work every day. And so, you know, you'd come out, you'd have to be at work at 5, so you'd have to leave at 4 a.m. And then you'd come out and have to completely, like, de-ice the car, which was a whole new experience for me. Whew, it was very challenging, and I just had to keep reminding myself, I'm so lucky to be here. I love this job.
Now, there's so many moments that leave you hanging in Castle Rock. Can you give us... No, you can't give us any spoilers. You can't tell us anything about what's coming, can you?
No. I'd get in so much trouble.
Well, we don't want that to happen, but we also want to talk about some of your other work, and I'm so excited to talk with you about a television show that is one of my favorite of all time. Mark Duplass is a wonderful friend of the show. He comes on with us quite a lot. Togetherness, I think, it's one of those shows I feel like people will look back in a few years and say, how is it possible that lasted only 2 seasons? It was such a great show.
That makes me want to cry. That's so sweet. It was such a special, special one for me. I mean, it was a real dream job, and the Duplass brothers are so brilliant. And to get to work on that kind of material and then have such creative freedom, I mean, they liked us to improvise, so most of the show was improvised, and it was a real dream. A part of me still hopes they could somehow bring it back, you know, like the comeback came back 10 years later, so you never know.
Well, and Michelle was such an honest, such a real character, and I have to tell you this, is I work with young actors, and I've used you as an example before of the ultimate actor, because I never see you acting. You embody your character so much.
Oh, thank you. That's honestly the nicest thing I could hear about my work. Thank you for saying that.
You've also worked with another friend of our show, Joe Swanberg, on Digging for Fire, which was a wonderful independent film.
Yeah, that was a really fun one. And I did another movie with him called Happy Christmas, which was so much fun. I really like Joe. That's much more improvised than the Duplass brothers, but it's kind of in the same world. I love working that way.
We're talking with Melanie Linsky on Downtown. Let's talk about your long-running role in 2 and a Half Men. What was that experience like for you?
It's funny because it was, I was just sort of recurring on the show, so I'd come and go, but it was 13 years of my life. But it's strange to have a place that you kind of drop in on every once in a while for such a long period of time. I think I still, somewhere in my mind, I feel like it's still going and I could be called in. It's hard to get used to the fact that it's not really on anymore, because, you know, sometimes I do one episode in the whole season. But it was a really, for me, I did the first episode that I ever did of it because I was curious about a sitcom. I was like, what's that experience like? And that aspect of it was really incredible, because people became such fans of the show, and then they'd get to come to a taping, and the reactions you would get, because people loved and knew the characters, it was so, there's kind of nothing like it. It was very intense and interesting, yeah.
I want to talk about
a few... different from anything else I've ever done.
Well, I'll bet. I want to talk about a few of your films as well. One of my favorites of the last decade or so is the wonderful Up in the Air. Is it true that you hid your New Zealand accent from Jason Reitman?
Yeah, I guess the casting director said that he doesn't like to cast people who are not doing their own accent. And I find it very easy to do an American accent when I'm acting, but as myself, like a lot of actors will just have an American accent on all the time because it's easier than switching in and out, but I feel very inauthentic if I'm talking as myself. Even when I'm getting notes from a director, I'll talk in my own accent. It's just a weird thing in my brain where it just feels strange. So I got the advice to not do my New Zealand accent in front of him in case he got scared off, and just to talk to him in an American accent, but then that meant I couldn't talk. It felt like I was lying. So I did the American accent when I did the audition, and then he gave me a couple of notes, and I just silently nodded. I don't know what he thought of me.
I also
it's been crazy.
I
don't know. He gave me the part. So.
I loved your work as well, and a great little movie with Paul Giamatti called Win-Win.
Oh, I'm so happy you saw that. Not a lot of people saw that, so that's really nice. Thanks.
And another movie I want to mention, because you were just incredible, and it was such a powerful performance, and you had the responsibility of carrying the film. What was it like working on Hello, I Must Be Going?
You really, this is the greatest interview ever. You're just naming all my favorites. That honestly is maybe the most special experience I've ever had. I'm not one of those actors who looks to see how many scenes they have or anything like that. I had a sense that the character was in a lot of the film, but it was only when we were shooting that I realized there was not a scene that I wasn't in. So I kept kind of waiting to have a break, and then I was like, hang on a minute, I think I'm in every scene in this movie. So it was quite a lot. But, oh gosh, Blythe Danner played my mother, and the amazing Chris Abbott was my younger love interest, and it just was such a special time, and I think the movie is so special, and it kind of changed my life in a lot of ways. So that's the thing that got me to get in this.
So,
Plus or Hello, I Must Be Going, and yeah.
What do you look for in scripts? Because your taste must be the same as mine, because I love so many of the choices you've made, and they're such wonderful films. What do you look for in a character or in a script?
It just needs to feel real to me on some level. It just needs to resonate in a way that feels human and feels authentic. And I like things that talk about things in a way that I haven't seen before, that feel kind of unexpected. It just has to resonate with me on some level. I've read a lot of wonderful scripts that I just don't feel that same connection to, and I don't quite know why, but I'll only do things that kind of speak to me internally in some way.
Now, I have a four-year-old, so in our house, at least to my son, your voice is most recognizable for your work on Jake and the Neverland Pirates and Summer Camp Island.
Oh, that's cute. Oh, four-year-old. Yeah, it's so fun doing animated stuff. I really love it.
Let's go back to the beginning, Melanie, and how did you find Peter Jackson, or how did Peter Jackson find you to get this whole thing started?
Well, I was at high school in New Plymouth, New Zealand, which is out on the West Coast, and some people came to the school casting a movie, and I would write plays and put plays on, and I did a lot of local theater, and I'd heard about it, and I decided to go and audition, and it was just a sort of improvised audition, because they didn't want to tell anyone who was making the movie or what the script was about. It was all very top secret. And then I got another audition where they flew me to meet with Peter Jackson, and they had already cast Kate Winslet in the movie. And so before my second audition, Peter sort of sat me down and said, you know, we have this professional actress from England. She's been doing television and commercials since she was 12 years old. She's very seasoned. And I'm going to show you her audition tape so you get a sense of the level that we need you to be at. And I said, all right. And then I was shown Kate Winslet's audition tape, which is just like cruel, really. I mean, she's like one of our greatest actresses. Even though she was only 17 at the time, it's pretty intimidating. And I was like, okay, then give it a go, I guess. I'll see if I can get there. And, you know, thankfully they gave me the part, which was just kind of one of the luckiest, maybe the luckiest thing that's ever happened to me. It was amazing.
Well, it started a wonderful career that is still going strong. Melanie Lynskey appears as Molly Strand in Castle Rock, and if it's what we've seen so far has been terrific, we love it. And again, to me, it's like everything you do, it's filled with great honesty and truth. I think you're one of the best actors we have in the business right now, and it's a delight for us to get to talk with you.
Thank you. It was so wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time.
That's Melanie Lynskey talking about Castle Rock and more with us here on The Best of Downtown. And it's It's unexpected when you talk to her for the first time and you get that New Zealand accent.
Yeah, I mean, as much as I've seen her in things over the year, I had no clue that she had an accent.
Well, and I thought it was interesting when she mentioned in the interview that when she's playing a part, she tends to just do it in an American accent. And even when they stop shooting, if she's on set, she stays with that American accent just to keep it sharp. But she says she can't just jump into it, which is why when she auditioned for Up in the Air with Jason Reitman, she just wouldn't talk unless she was on camera, which is pretty interesting. But what a delight, what a terrific actress, Melanie Lynskey, joining us this morning. Thanks to her. Thanks to author Mark Deano, relationship expert Dr. Laura Ciel, and our friend Dennis Price, who was filling in that day, sitting in with us. I don't know if Dr. Laura has recovered from that experience yet.
Well, we got to get Dennis back in here. That was a lot of fun.
That was indeed. And, of course, Chad Finn of the Boston Globe. Thanks to you for being with us and making us a part of your Sunday as well. We're back tomorrow afternoon to Brand Spankin' New Downtown. And another favorite of the show, comedian Paula Poundstone, coming back to Maine for some shows this month. And she's always a delight to chat with. That'll be tomorrow afternoon. Plus, Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald, movie reviews from Alan Adams of the Maine Edge, and more. Have a great rest of your weekend. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon at 4 for Downtown, right here on Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna-